Hello, and welcome to the audio tape portion of English 9. Long before we had books or English courses, a good tale well told was sure to gather a crowd of eager listeners. To give you a sense of how a poem or story can come to life, we've asked two writers from Victoria, British Columbia, to read aloud some of the works discussed in your course. Robin Skelton's career began when he was 8 years old with a manuscript entitled The Storm. He's since written 124 books and claims he's earned the right not to have his first manuscript quoted in public. Linda Rogers has published several books of poetry for adults and runs a company that publishes children's books. Both these writers regularly read their own works in public, but on these tapes, they're reading the works of others. Listen to each piece when you're directed to do so in your course activities. Listen for the way words have been used to express ideas and feelings, and the way the reader has used his or her voice to convey meaning. But most importantly, enjoy each poem or story for what it's meant to be: entertainment. This sound will tell you when each piece has ended. English 9, Family Matters.
14th Birthday by Phyllis McGinley. The enemy, who wears her mother's usual face and confidential tone, has access. Doubtless, stares into her writing case and listens on the phone. Her fortress crumbles. Spies who call themselves her betters harry her night and day. Herself's the single prize. Likely they read her letters and bear the tale away, or eavesdrop on her sleep, uncountered and unchidden, to learn her dreams by heart. There is no lock will keep a secret rightly hidden from their subversive art. But till the end is sure, till on some open plain they bring her to her knees, she'll face them down, endure in silence and disdain love's utmost treacheries.
Because I Never Learned by Patrick Lane. Because I never learned how to be gentle, and the country I lived in was hard with dead animals and men, I didn't question my father when he told me to step on the kitten's head after the bus had run over its hind quarters. Now, 20 years later, I remember only the silence of the dying when the fragile skull collapsed under my hard, bare heel, the curved tongue in the dust that would never cry again, and the small of my father's back as he walked tall away.
Follower by Seamus Heaney. My father worked with a horse plow, his shoulders globed like a full sail strung between the shafts and the furrow. The horses strained at his clicking tongue. An expert, he would set the wing and fit the bright steel-pointed sock. The sod rolled over without breaking. At the head rig, with a single pluck of reins, the sweating team turned round and back into the land. His eye narrowed and angled at the ground, mapping the furrow exactly. I stumbled in his hobnailed wake, fell sometimes on the polished sod. Sometimes he rode me on his back, dipping and rising to his plod. I wanted to grow up and plow, to close one eye, stiffen my arm. All I ever did was follow in his broad shadow round the farm. I was a nuisance, tripping, falling, yapping always. But today it is my father who keeps stumbling behind me and will not go away.
The Lesson by Edward Lucy Smith. Your father's gone, my bald headmaster said, his shiny dome and brown tobacco jar splintered at once in tears. It wasn't grief. I cried for knowledge, which was bitterer than any grief, for there and then I knew that grief has uses, that a father dead could bind the bully's fist a week or two, and then I cried for shame, then for relief. I was a month past 10 when I learned this. I still remember how the noise was stilled in school assembly when my grief came in. Some goldfish in a bowl quietly sculled around their shining prison on its shelf. They were indifferent. All the other eyes were turned towards me. Somewhere in myself, pride, like a goldfish, flashed a sudden fin.
Lament by Edna St. Vincent Millay. Listen, children, your father is dead. From his old coats I'll make you little jackets. I'll make you little trousers from his old pants. There'll be in his pockets things he used to put there, keys and pennies covered with tobacco. Dan shall have the pennies to save in his bank. Anne shall have the keys to make a pretty noise with. Life must go on, and the dead be forgotten. Life must go on, though good men die. Anne, eat your breakfast. Dan, take your medicine. Life must go on. I forget just why.
Aunt Sarah Died One Summer Night by Lisa Hirschberg. Aunt Sarah died on a wicker chair on the porch one summer night with a cold lemonade and a Japanese fan and a dozen nightbugs dancing around the 60-watt bulb, while the crickets chattered in the lawn and the dog scratched and bit at his fur and the big black horsefly buzzed around the ceiling in our hot, sticky kitchen, while Matt and I kicked off our sneakers and ran over the wet grass, grabbing at the night for fireflies, while Ma and Pa were driving to town in the green vegetable truck that smelt like tomatoes. While Mary and her beau sat under the silver maple with leaves as big as hands, just watching the sky and saying nothing. While the bullfrogs, hidden in the cattails, belched from swelling up with too much summer air. Aunt Sarah died, and the wind stroked her white curls, and a thrush perched on the highest branch sang her very favourite song, and the moon shone bright so she wouldn't stumble going up the golden stairs to heaven.
A Day No Pigs Would Die by Robert Newton Peck. Chapter 1. I should have been in school that April day, but instead I was up on the ridge near the old spar mine above our farm, whipping the gray trunk of a rock maple with a dead stick, and hating Edward Thatcher. During recess, he'd pointed at my clothes and made sport of them. Instead of tying into them, I'd turn tail and run off. And when Miss Malcolm rang the bell to call us back inside, I was halfway home. Picking up a stone, I threw it into some bracken ferns hard as I could. Someday, that was how hard I was going to light into Edward Thatcher and make him bleed like a stuck pig. I'd kick him from one end of Vermont to the other and sorry him good. I'd teach him not to make fun of Shaker ways. He'd never show his face in the town of Learning ever again. No, sir. A painful noise made me whip my head around and jump at the same time. When I saw her, I knew she was in bad trouble. It was the big Holstein cow, one of many that belonged to our near neighbor, Mr. Tanner. This one he called Apron, because she was mostly black except for the white along her belly, which went up her front and around her neck like a big, clean apron. She was his biggest cow, Mr. Tanner told Papa, and his best milker. And he was fixing up to take her to Rutland Fair come summer. As I ran toward her, she made her dreadful noise again. I got close up and saw why. Her big body was pumping up and down, trying to have her calf. She'd fell down, and there was blood on her foreleg, and her mouth was all thick and foamy with yellow-green spit. I tried to reach my hand out and pat her head, but she was wild-eyed and mean, and making this breezy noise almost every breath. Turning away from me, she showed me her swollen rump. Her tail was up and arched high, whipping through the air with every heave of her back. Sticking out of her was the head and one hoof of her calf. His head was so covered with blood and bursop that I had no way of telling he was alive or dead until I heard him bawl. Apron went crashing through the pucker bush, me right behind. I'd never caught up, but because she had to stop and strain, I got to the calf's head and got a purchase on him. He was so covered with slime and Apron was so wandering, there was no holding to it. Besides, being just 12 years old, I weighed a bit over 100 pounds. Apron was comfortable over 1,000, and it wasn't much of a tug for her. As I went down, losing my grip on the calf's neck, her hoof caught my shin bone, and it really smarted. The only thing that made me get up and give the whole idea another go was when he bawled again. I just wound up running away from Edward Thatcher and running away from the schoolhouse. I was feathered if I was going to run away from one darn more thing. I needed a rope, but there wasn't any, so I had to make one. It didn't have to be long, just strong. Chasing old Apron through the next patch of pricker sure took some fun out of the whole business. I made my mistake of trying to take my trousers off as I ran. No good. So I sat down in the prickers, yanked them off over my boots, and caught up to Apron. After a few bad tries, I got one pant leg round her calf's head and knotted it snug. "Calf," I said to him, "you stay up your ma's hindside, and you're about to choke. So you might as well choke getting yourself born." Whatever old Apron decided that I was doing to her back yonder, she didn't take kindly to it. So she started off again with me in the rear, hanging on to wait Christmas, and my own bare butt and privates catching a thorn with every step, and that calf never coming one inch closer to coming out. But when Apron stopped to heave again, I got the other pant leg around a dogwood tree that was about thick as a fence post. Now, only three things could happen. My trousers would rip, Apron would just uproot the tree, the calf would slide out. But nothing happened. Apron just stood shaking and heaving and straining and never moved forward a step. I got the other pant leg knotted about the dogwood, and like Apron, I didn't know what to do next. Her calf bawled once more, making a weaker noise than before. But all old Apron did was heave in that one place. "You old bitch!" I yelled at her, grabbing a dead blackberry cane that was as long as a bullwhip and big around as a broom handle. "You move that big black smelly ass! You hear?" I never hit anybody, boy or beast, as I hit that cow. I beat her so hard I was crying. Where I held the big cane, the thorns were chewing up my hands real bad. But it only got me madder. I kicked her and stoned her. I kicked her again one last time so hard in the udder that I thought I heard her grunt. Both her hindquarters sort of hunkered down in the brush. Then she started forward. My trousers went tight. I heard a rip and a calf bawl, and a big hunk of hot stinking stuff went all over me. Some of it was calf, some of it wasn't. As I went down under the force and weight of it, I figured something either got dead or got born. All I knew was that I was snarled up in a passel of wet stuff, and there was a strong cord holding me against something that was very hot and kicked a lot. I brushed some of the slop away from my eyes and looked up. And there was Apron, her big black head and her big black mouth licking, first me and then her calf. But she was far from whole. Her mouth was open and she was gasping for air. She stumbled once. I thought for sure I was going to wind up being under a very big cow. The noise in her throat came at me again, and her tongue lashed to and fro like the tail of a clock. It looked to me as if there was something in her mouth. She would start to breathe, and then, like a cork in a bottle, some darn thing in there would cut it off. Her big body swayed like she was dizzy or sick. As the front of her fell to her knees, her head hit my chest as I lay on the ground, her nose almost touching my chin. She had stopped breathing. Her jaw was locked open, so I put my hand into her mouth, but felt only her swollen tongue. I stretched my fingers up into her throat, and there it was, a hard ball about apple size. It was stuck in her windpipe or her gullet. I didn't know which and didn't care. So I shut my eyes, grabbed it, and yanked. Somebody told me once that a cow won't bite. That somebody is as wrong as sin on Sunday. I thought my arm had got sawed off partway between elbow and shoulder. She bit and bit and never let go. She got to her feet and kept on biting. That devil cow ran down off that ridge with my arm in her mouth and dragging me half naked with her. What she didn't do to me with her teeth, she did with her front hoofs. It should have been broad daylight, but it was night, black night. As black and as bloody and as bad as getting hurt again and again could ever be. It just went on and on. It didn't quit.
English 9, Beyond Reality.
Alligator on the Escalator by Eve Merriam. Through the revolving door of a department store, there slithered an alligator. When he came to the escalator, he stepped upon the track with great dexterity. His tail draped over the railing, and he clicked his teeth in glee. Yo! I'm off on the escalator, excited as I can be. It's a moving experience, as you can plainly see. On the moving stair, I go anywhere. I rise to the top, past outerwear, innerwear, dinnerwear, thinnerwear, then down to the basement with bargains galore, then back on the track to the top once more. Oh, I may ride the escalator until closing time or later. So tell the telephone operator to call Mrs. Albert Q. Alligator and tell her to take a hot mud bath and not to wait up for me.
Ride a Wild Horse by Hannah Kahn. Ride a wild horse with purple wings, striped yellow and black, except his head, which must be red. Ride a wild horse against the sky, hold tight to his wings. Before you die, whatever else you leave undone, once ride a wild horse into the sun. The Witch of Coas by Robert Frost. I stayed the night for shelter at a farm behind the mountain with a mother and son, two old believers. They did all the talking.
Folks think a witch who has familiar spirits. She could call up to pass a winter evening, but won't. Should be burned at the stake or something. Summoning spirits isn't button-button who's got the button. I would have them know.
Mother can make a common table rear and kick with two legs like an army mule.
And when I've done it, what good have I done? Rather than tip a table for you, let me tell you what Raoul Asuncontrol once told me. He said the dead had souls, but when I asked him how could that be, I thought the dead were souls. He broke my trance. Don't that make you suspicious that there's something the dead are keeping back? Yes, there's something the dead are keeping back.
You wouldn't want to tell him what we have up attic, Mother?
Bones. A skeleton.
But the headboard of Mother's bed is pushed against the attic door. The door is nailed. It's harmless. Mother hears it in the night, halting perplexed behind the barrier of door and headboard. What it wants to get is back into the cellar, where it came from.
We'll never let them, will we, son? We'll never.
It left the cellar 40 years ago and carried itself like a pile of dishes up one flight from the cellar to the kitchen, another from the kitchen to the bedroom, another from the bedroom to the attic, right past both father and mother, and neither stopped it. Father had gone upstairs, mother was downstairs. I was a baby. I don't know where I was.
The only fault my husband found with me, I went to sleep before I went to bed. Especially in winter, when the bed might just as well be ice and the clothes snow. The night the bones came up the cellar stairs, Tophil had gone to bed alone and left me, but left an open door to cool the room off, so as to sort of turn me out of it. I was just coming to myself enough to wonder where the cold was coming from, when I heard Tophil upstairs in the bedroom, and thought I heard him downstairs in the cellar. The board we had laid down to walk dry shod on when there was water in the cellar in spring struck the hard cellar bottom. And then someone began the stairs, 2 footsteps for each step, the way a man with one leg and a crutch or a little child comes up. It wasn't Tophil. It wasn't anyone who could be there. The bulkhead double doors were double locked and swollen tight and buried under snow. The cellar windows were banked up with sawdust and swollen tight and buried under snow. It was the bones. I knew them, and good reason. My first impulse was to get to the knob and hold the door, but the bones didn't try the door. They halted helpless on the landing, waiting for things to happen in their favor. The faintest restless rustling ran all through them. I never could have done the thing I did if the wish hadn't been too strong in me to see how they were mounted for this walk. I had a vision of them put together, not like a man, but like a chandelier. So suddenly I flung the door wide on him. A moment he stood balancing with emotion and all but lost himself. A tongue of fire flashed out and licked along his upper teeth. Smoke rolled inside the sockets of his eyes. Then he came at me with one hand outstretched, the way he did in life once. But this time I struck the hand off brittle on the floor and fell back from him on the floor myself. The finger pieces slid in all directions. Where did I see one of those pieces lately? Hand me my button box. It must be there. I sat up on the floor and shouted, Tophil, it's coming up to you. It had its choice of the door to the cellar or the hall. It took the hall door for the novelty and set off briskly for so slow a thing, still going every which way in the joints, though, so that it looked like lightning or a scribble from the slap I had just now given its hand. I listened till it almost climbed the stairs from the hall to the only finished bedroom, before I got up to do anything, then ran and shouted, Shut the bedroom door, Tophil, for my sake. Company, he said, don't make me get up. I'm too warm in bed. So lying forward weakly on the handrail, I pushed myself upstairs, and in the light, the kitchen had been dark. I had to own I could see nothing. Tophil, I don't see it. It's with us in the room, though. It's the bones. What bones? the cellar bones, out of the grave. That made him throw his bare legs out of bed and sit up by me and take hold of me. I wanted to put out the light and see if I could see it, or else mow the room with our arms at the level of our knees and bring the chalk pile down. I'll tell you what, it's looking for another door to try. The uncommonly deep snow has made him think of his old song, The Wild Colonial Boy. He always used to sing along the tote road. He's after an open door to get outdoors. Let's trap him with an open door up attic. Tophil agreed to that, and sure enough, almost the moment he was given an opening, the steps began to climb the attic stairs. I heard them. Tophil didn't seem to hear them. Quick! I slammed to the door and held the knob. Tophil, get nails! I made him nail the door shut and push the headboard of the bed against it. Then we asked, was there anything up attic that we'd ever want again? The attic was less to us than the cellar. If the bones liked the attic, let them have it. Let them stay in the attic. When they sometimes come down the stairs at night and stand perplexed behind the door and headboard of the bed, brushing their chalky skull with chalky fingers, with sounds like the dry rattling of a shutter, that's when I sit up in the dark to say, to no one any more since Tophil died. Let them stay in the attic since they went there. I promised Tophil to be cruel to them for helping them be cruel once to him.
We think they had a grave down in the cellar.
We know they had a grave down in the cellar.
We never could find out whose bones they were.
Yes, we could too, son. Tell the truth for once. They were a man's his father killed for me. I mean, a man he killed instead of me. The least I could do was to help dig their grave. We were about it one night in the cellar. Son knows the story, but 'twas not for him to tell the truth. Suppose the time had come. Son looked surprised to see me end a lie we'd kept all these years between ourselves, so as to have it ready for outsiders. But tonight, I don't care enough to lie. I don't remember why I ever cared. Tophil, if he were here, I don't believe could tell you why he ever cared himself.
She hadn't found the finger bone she wanted among the buttons poured out in her lap. I verified the name next morning. Tophil, the rural letterbox said. Tophil Ladgway.